Phyllida Lloyd is a successful director working in many fields, opera and film, films such as Mamma Mia and The Iron Lady, well known, as well as theatre. Her most recent stage production, Julius Caesar at the Donmar, has been the subject of animated discussion and wildly different responses. The entire cast is female, with several outstanding actors in leading roles. Harriet Walter is Brutus, Francis Barber Caesar, Jenny Jules Cassius, and Cush Jumbo Mark Antony. My name's Heather Neal, and I'm with Phyllida Lloyd now at her home in London to talk to Theatre Voice about this production. Well, first of all, it's quite understandable that any woman director would want to give females a bit more opportunity to get to some of the major roles in Shakespeare than they normally have. Was there some connection between your wanting to do an all-female play, however, and the new regime at the Donmar, led by Josie Rourke, a woman for the first time there?
Yes, when Josie Rourke and Kate Pakenham took over the Donmar, and this is the first time an all-female regime has taken the keys of one of the big, so-called big-hitter London theatres, they asked me what I would do for them if I were to do a play there. And I said, well, first of all, it will be a production that makes the women in the audience feel they are at least 50% represented on the stage. And when I saw the sort of look of sort of huge affirmation from them both of that, I thought, oh, to hell with this. Why not 100% represented? And there began our conversation about what the play might be.
And why Julius Caesar? Because on the face of it, it seems a rather unusual choice. I mean, it's so male. I have seen all-female productions of The Shrew and Much Ado at the Globe, and they had their difficulties. But Julius Caesar, hardly any females at all.
Yes. I, in fact, directed the all-female Taming of the Shrew at the Globe with Janet McTeer and Catherine Hunter. And I recognised then how the plays, the themes of the plays, can be released by a single gender company, male or female. But having done a comedy, which somehow it's kind of quite easy to release a playfulness in the comedies by taking performing them with one gender or another. But I wanted to choose a play whose themes were not purely romantic, and in which the women in the play, the female characters, were not necessarily romantic heroines, and to give a lot of women a chance to speak text that in territory that they would never have been in. So, for example, it's very rare for a woman to be actually, to coin a phrase, sticking the knife in a classical play. I mean, Medea is a singular exception, where she actually gets to commit murder, albeit off stage. But usually the female character is the murderer's wife, or indeed the despot's wife, but rarely the despot, rarely the revolutionary, usually the revolutionary's wife, as in Portia. So to the ambition was to put as many women as possible in new territory.
And then you've chosen to set the production in a women's prison. Was that to give you a sort of brutal regime to start to work in, where you've got a lot of people together already, as it were, a group?
Yes, in a way, the prison is a mirror of Rome. And we had been, we had discovered that Julius Caesar's Rome was a prison for the conspirators. Their freedoms had been severely curtailed. Freedom of speech was curtailed. Their freedom of movement was seriously curtailed. And so in some way it was a kind of metaphor for the claustrophobia, powerlessness and fury of Rome. But it was also a way of, in one stroke, de-sexing the women in the company, putting them into androgynous, the women are wearing prison uniform. And as soon as they walk on and line up, there is a kind of sexlessness about them. And frankly, we could afford to do that, which had I decided to do it in leather and broadswords, the Donmar would have struggled to be able to find that budget. So it was both pragmatic, but actually it was it seemed to chime very well with the play.
Mm. So this does mean that all the characters are playing, as it were, two people at once, because they've been cast in this play. Is the idea that the roles they play reflect how they are as prisoners?
We did a lot of work on the prison background, and in fact Harriet Walter and I spent some weeks prior to the rehearsal beginning working in Holloway Prison with a group of women on Julius Caesar. We wrote to the governor and asked if they would be interested in exploring the play, because I was keen to establish whether indeed this idea that the play would speak to a group of women who'd lost their freedom was indeed the case. So our work began before we actually came together with the acting company. But then, once there, we did begin to build characters, prison characters. And yes, there is, even though the audience may only feel it subliminally, there is a link. Harriet Walter, for example's character is someone who's committed a crime in a political situation many years ago. She's an intellectual. She's somebody who the prisoners look to for a kind of moral yardstick. She helps them with their reading, their writing, and she's she has a status because of both her education and her crime. We collaborated with the theatre company Clean Break, who work with ex-offenders, and there are two members of Clean Break in the company who also helped us build the world of the prison.
Mm. Harriet Walter looks extraordinary. She looks so unlike we've ever seen her look before. In fact, she reminded me a bit of Greg Hicks.
Yeah, she's been described as sort of a cross between Greg Hicks and David Bowie, actually.
Yes.
I mean, Harriet, I think, has found, as have several of the actors, an extraordinary freedom in playing this role. I think that the actresses describe the narrow spectrum with which they are often often confined in a rehearsal period. They showed me a sort of a slice of the cheesecake, as it were, that they think they often occupy in terms of the potential, both intellectual potential, physical potential. And so to suddenly be able to take up more space and be entitled to a great deal more of, yes, the airtime, but the range of emotion that Brutus goes through in the piece, she has feasted on this and is finding it very stimulating. Mm.
Well, they're being two female characters at a time. They're also being, as it were, male and female. Do they think, I mean, there are actually lines referring to each other as men, and which you haven't changed at all. So are they thinking of themselves as men who happen to look like women, or is this all irrelevant?
No, it isn't irrelevant. I think that in many ways, it's a little like when we were working in Holloway Prison, and I asked the prisoners there when they were performing the conspiracy scene in which the conspirators go to Brutus's house the night before the murder. And I suddenly stopped them and said, "Girls, are you playing men or women now?" And the girl who was playing Brutus turned to me and said, "More like the character." And I think that's very similar to the way that the girls at the Donmar feel, that the first port of call has been, what does my character feel and do? rather than worrying about acting male, but actually they are playing men, but it's not a big step once you've been denuded of all your, first of all, they're not wearing makeup, they are, as I say, in these very androgynous prison uniforms. And once you also, yes, so we started with the characters. Of course, it becomes evident when a female character comes onto the stage. That's when you suddenly realise they're playing men, because of how the female characters behave with the men in the scene.
And there are relationships going on already between the prison characters, aren't there, which feed in somewhat into the relationships. I mean, there's a very intense relationship between Cassius and Brutus, and of course Caesar, who is a bully who they all feel they have to kowtow to.
Yes, there's an emotional relationship between Brutus and Cassius, and a sexual relationship between Caesar and Mark Antony in the prison, which in some way is a mirror for the relationships in the piece. And this really helps underpin the action on the stage, because it's quite hard to establish with Brutus and Cassius because of the way Shakespeare writes the exposition. You're on the one hand being asked to believe that these two men are, well, they are actually historically brothers-in-law. And yet, there's something rather remote once the exposition is being laid out at the beginning of the play. It's quite hard to really believe that the two of them are as intimate as you're supposed to believe they are. But somehow the prison setting reassures us that they do know each other, they do have a long history, and they are living in the same place.
Yes, the claustrophobia helps that, doesn't it? Caesar, of course, played by Frances Barber, appears far more often than he would in any other production. We have her reminding us perhaps of her other role in the prison, as well as of what they've done over and over again.
Yes, the subtext in our production is that between them, Caesar and Brutus have decided to do this play. We know exactly what the history of that is, but for the audience, it's evident that Caesar is in some controlling role of the production, and perhaps has chosen to play Caesar herself, and does indeed remain guiding the action, watching the action, controlling the action to some extent, which is very much in Shakespeare's play, that the characters, they've killed Caesar, but they feel they can never really shake Caesar off and keep seeing him on the battlefield. And I think that what we were exploring was, the play is about regime change, and it's about how easy it is, perhaps comparatively easy, to depose the dictator, the despot, but then what happens? How hard it is to move on to the next regime, how you carve out the peace, as it were, after the war, and how easy it is to descend into factions. And in some way, this play, which is a story of an attempt to bring down a despotic power, is perhaps the character Caesar's in our production, who turns out to be, in fact, part of the prison regime, is a prison officer. It's as if she's saying to them, you can try and attack the system, you can try and bring it down, but God help you, because ultimately you'll never ever beat it, you'll never throw it off, you'll never get free of this this regime of which you are a part. And indeed, she's the one who hurries them back to their cells at the end and turns out the lights.
Yes, and Brutus is the most reluctant to go.
Yes, and it, and again, the other resonance that we're trying to allow for the audience is that these prisoners have had, it is in some way about freedom of speech, what we're exploring, that the prisoners have had a taste of creative freedom for a moment. Mm. They've had the chance to speak, to hear their voices mm. speak these words and these ideas.
And explore emotion aloud. Sort of.
Yes. And at the end, they're being slammed back down. And mm. I think that Brutus feels this loss most greatly, because Brutus is the idealist, is the person with the vision that somehow this idea, this idealized idea of Rome, or a Rome that once was there that now has become corrupted, could be rediscovered, and that somehow this is all lost at the mm. end.
Well, Antony isn't as brilliant a politician as Cassius might be. In fact, the moral high ground is an awkward one to be on if you're going to be the new leader, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think that's the problem, that the person who is on the moral high ground, the sort of, as some would describe Brutus, you know, the woolly liberal, is not necessarily the person equipped to deal with the chaos. And in a way, Mark Antony's journey is interesting, because he's, at the beginning, he appears to be not really at the centre of the political regime, but he comes through and manages through rhetoric to manipulate the crowd in the chaos and step up to take the reins. But again, he's a victim of the descent into factions that occurs and is very quickly embattled with Octavius. And at the end of the play, we're suggesting, partly because Octavius has the last word, whatever else Shakespeare, you know, doesn't tell you, the next bit of history, that Octavius went on to sort of become the next Caesar, really, become a king, that it's all lost to Antony. So his is a short taste of power.
Mm. Well, the play begins not in Julius Caesar. We are in the prison, and you've introduced some lines about reading your stars in the newspaper and so on.
Yes, and we've really taken the opening, the first scene with Julius Caesar from the play, in which the soothsayer warns Caesar that he should beware the Ides of March, and set this in a prison where Caesar actually really laughs off in public, laughs off the soothsayer's warning. Mm. And yes, we've somehow set that in the prison, and then just through sliding doors, gone into the Shakespeare straight after that. We did originally play the tribune scene at the beginning of the play, in which the tribunes berate the people for their obsession with Caesar and try to remind them that very lately they've been worshipping Caesar's predecessor, Pompey. But in the end, we felt that it didn't necessarily help our production, and that trying to establish the character or the idea of Pompey in the prison was not very easy, so we've cut it. And in fact, I've cut the play heavily.
Yes, it's very speedy. It's we go straight through in 2 hours without an interval.
Yes, I mean, you know, it's tricky, because it's interesting. Obviously, there were no intervals in Shakespeare's time, so an Elizabethan audience would have been very used to that, that momentum and that lack of sort of disjunction that an interval gives you. So we were determined to have that, and it seemed inappropriate in a prison. And we're trying to make the audience believe they are in a prison.
Yes,
so
where would they go? They can't go out for
send
a drink.
Them out into the plush bars of the Donmar. You know, when I last went to see a piece of theatre in Wandsworth Prison, the last thing we were given was an interval drinks. We've got through Caesar in just under 2 hours, but by cutting about 30% of the text.
Mm. Yes, that is quite a lot, but you've got everything you need, as it were, for your way of telling it.
Yes, I mean, and there is quite a lot of repetition in Shakespeare.
And his battles are always a bit of a...
Yeah, the last third of the play is notoriously tricky, and I think my mission was, first of all, we set out to create a company that in which the verse speaking was world class. Harriet and I both agreed that we were likely to be, there were people going to be gunning for us just with the idea we were going to do this, an all-female production. We knew we were vulnerable just by declaring our intentions. But the one thing we were not going to be, we were not going to make ourselves vulnerable over, was the verse speaking. Mm. So we worked very, very hard.
It is brilliant.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's partly having the choices we made of actors, that we chose people, regardless of their experience, but people who had an absolutely instinctive feeling for it. And what's interesting has been that some of those people have no experience whatsoever. Others have 30 or 40 years experience. But everybody was picked, firstly, for that skill. And then we worked very hard with Barbara Hausman, our voice coach, and Every Hour God Sends, to really make sure that they owned the text entirely. And if they were, you know, we've made tiny changes to the text, words, tiny changes. We've replaced words where we think there's a sort of tripwire for the audience, there's an ambiguity that you're still shaking off 5 minutes later or a couple of minutes later in a scene. So we've left no stone unturned to really make the audience engage with the text. But the last third of the play, as I say, is very difficult. Shakespeare introduces a number of new characters and then asks you to feel sorry when they commit suicide, for example, in the case of the character Titinius. And so I've made quite a lot of dramaturgical adjustments to that. And indeed, I've carried the conspirators, Casca and Trebonius, through into the war, partly because historically, as I understand it, Casca did go on to fight those battles and may well have committed suicide himself on the battlefield. Now, actually, in our production, Casca is assassinated at the end by Octavius Caesar once he's shut down the television cameras. So that happens, as it were, off stage. And that's to really show the kind of brutality and, I suppose, the continuum of violence and brutality of the regime. But we've tried to express the war partly through music.
Yes, you have a drum kit on stage.
Yes, we do. And in somehow the fury of the drummer and the fury of the rock music, which is a particular genre of thrash metal, which is very, very martial and terrible if you're stuck in a very small room with it. The music is there to express the horror and fury of war in a way that we weren't sure that running round the Donmar, you know, waving swords, was entirely going to be able to capture that.
Well, once we get into Julius Caesar, it's very intense, but you are daring enough to allow the prison to break through again. Harriet Walter suddenly turns round after an amazing speech and tells them all to shut the fuck up.
Yes, she does. I think that particular moment was to... that moment in the play, a poet, a sort of apparently slightly tipsy poet, suddenly breaks into Brutus's tent and it ostensibly sort of just tries to cheer Brutus and Cassius up and is given short shrift and really sent out of the tent with a flea in his ear. So there is a kind of disruption, a disturbance in the text, which I wasn't sure the actual scene of the poet breaking in, that we could make that work. But we have honoured that disturbance by that break-in, which is, in fact, it's as if the actors are giggling. Something's made them, as we call it in the theatre, corpse off stage, and they're unable to control their giggles. So this disturbance for me is at the sort of centre of what one is trying to recover, the kind of disturbance that there would have been in the theatre watching these plays in the late 16th century or early 17th century.
1599 was the first one.
Because the play is clearly about Elizabeth I, about it's a play about a long established ruler who people are discontented with, and
who has no heir.
And there are at the Elizabethan time there are rumblings of revolution from the Earl of Essex and other factions. There have been assassination attempts on Elizabeth, and Shakespeare is clearly exploring this idea of the potential assassination of her. And you could say that in some way he comes down on the side of Elizabeth I, or says in some way that a revolution is doomed to fail.
Quite ambiguous, though, isn't it?
It is very ambiguous. But and of course you could say, well, he's showing you something that actually he's like all great artists, writers, musicians, composers. He is several decades ahead of his time. He's writing. He's sort of prefiguring the fall of Charles I. But I think that one can imagine the frisson in the audience, who must have understood that the plays were speaking metaphorically about their own time, and the kind of tension in the audience of that. And of course, the alienation of having young boys playing Portia and Calpurnia. So this is a very heightened kind of theatre, a very unrealistic theatre, in which also the characters would have been wearing partly Elizabethan costume with a suggestion of Roman armour. So it would have been a bit like doing a play about Queen Victoria with her wearing, you know, jeans, but with a little bit of a sort of bustle or something over the top, but having her on a mobile phone, but with some sort of hints at the Victorian period. And I'm not sure that people quite... I think now we've become quite wedded to a comparatively... We think we can create these... We can present these plays quite realistically, but actually they're in... they're not really in a realistic world. And that's why I think it's easier for women to perform them, just as it's easy for men or an all-male company to perform them, than one might think, because it's already a heightened and alienating form. And in some way, there isn't a character of Brutus. There is a person on stage speaking a collection of existential and philosophical ideas, and that person becomes Brutus in front of your eyes.
Yeah. The murder of Cinna the poet, the innocent who just has the wrong name, is always horrible. It looks in this production as if it nearly gets out of hand, and some real scores are being settled.
Yes, again, there's a disturbance both before and after the scene of Cinna the poet, because the prisoner who is playing Cinna the poet only gets two or three lines into her scene before she's summarily removed for her meds, her medication, which is something that...
Oh, yes, that's sort of, true.
You know, you see, you think...
Yes, so you have to change the person playing.
Yes, so they send on, as they call it, a substitute to read in for the poet, who then, because... You know, yes, and the fight, the staged fight, does get out of hand, and she gets injured in the fight. And there's a moment where there's a possibility that the production will be stopped. And again, this is to underscore how fragile is the performer's control over the performance and how at any moment it could be stolen from them, which is a mirror of the characters in Rome and how fragile their hold over their reality is.
The murder of Caesar, which I found it hard to see because it happens in the front row of the audience, doesn't it? And she's being fed bleach, is that
she's,
right?
Yes, the first thing she first thing she's forced to do is to drink bleach before they begin to kill her with rubber knives. And this dates back to my work with Harriet in Holloway when we asked the prisoners how they might murder Caesar if they were doing this in a prison setting and they weren't allowed, real weapons. And they described how they would first make her drink bleach and then pour boiling water over her and various things that actually we have explored in rehearsal. But in the end, we left it with bleach and rubber knives.
But the bully, Frances Barber, is, before she sees her, has to agree to be doing that.
Yes.
I mean, obviously it's not real bleach, but on the other hand, she is in a humiliated position.
Yes, but it's also humiliated, but very, very starring. A great deal of attention has to be paid to these fights and these parts of the staging and Caesar's health and Caesar's safety, the character playing Caesar's safety, and somehow their centrality to all of that, again, seems a mirror of the sort of, how you star in death as you did in life.
Mm. Well, the other person who gets a lot of attention from the audience, perhaps at the end, unusually, is the soothsayer, still there, naked now, with a doll baby?
It's a doll.
Yes.
Yeah.
Does it represent a real baby, or is it meant to be a doll?
Both. The soothsayer is played by a fragile prisoner who's clearly something of an outsider and something of an annoyance to the other prisoners. When Caesar arrives at the beginning of the production, the soothsayer wants to speak to Caesar but is being fended off by Mark Antony, and Caesar implies, oh, here we go again, as in this person who, and she's also the same prisoner who is playing Cinna the poet, who is taken out for her meds. So she's clearly somebody who is perhaps an addict, someone who is sort of definitely at risk and troubled. And in our production, she's like some sort of wise child who pedals around on her tricycle with her doll sitting in the back of the tricycle. Someone who is on the margins, someone who has insight, but someone who is ignored. And when we see her wandering across the battlefield at the end, she's both the soothsayer, I suppose, reminding us that it was the soothsayer who predicted that everything would go wrong, or that somehow the Ides of March was D-Day for them all. But also she's an image of the sort of casualty of war, the child or the mother wandering through a battlefield holding, is it a doll or is it a child, we don't know. While these, it's to somehow show the sort of ironic that here we have a group of women storming across the battlefield dressed as men carrying Kalashnikovs, and we have a woman wandering through who is a sort of a victim of war. I suppose it's to try and show an image of real war.
Well, it's certainly a very gripping production. I suppose I should ask you whether you feel you lost anything by casting all females, or on the other hand, if you think it revealed a lot more about the text or other things about the text.
Well, I hope we're hearing parts of the text that perhaps in the past we've become used to burying, or we're hearing well-known lines in a completely new way because they're being spoken, as it were, with new music. I think women's voices are very different. There's in some way they're less powerful, but there's maybe more range of notes within them. And that we found it easy not to get stuck on what I call heroic acting, and sort of get stuck shouting, for example, which is a danger in those Roman plays. Everybody just shouts the whole way through the last third. And yes, I think I just hope that it's just a chance to, it is an experiment. It's a chance to hear the story afresh. Maybe to give young actresses, young women, a chance to look at it and think, oh yes, I could be part of this. This is a sort of world and a repertoire that I've been, perhaps I've disregarded because I've known I would be quite excluded from it. Perhaps to give more women a chance to look at it afresh, and men.
Thank you very much, Fernanda Loy. Thank you.